So, brothers in the Dhamma, what we're doing for the rest of the morning is I'm going to be talking to you about some aspects of the first part of the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, where Bhante speaks of the ten precepts collectively. It's really, as I said last night, I think this particular section requires a lot of study. It's very, very dense, and it can very easily be missed. And I think sometimes some of the passages that he goes into, we don't always get the full significance of what he's pointing to, perhaps. So I just wanted to make sure that we all are weighing very seriously the words he's using and the points that he's making. So there's an introduction, first of all, which gives the circumstances for him giving this lecture. That was the 1984, what we used to call WBO Day. We used to celebrate every year both the founding of the Western Buddhist Order, as it was called then, Trilokya Buddha Mahasangha, in India at that time. Now it's universally, of course, the Sri Ratna Buddhist Order. We celebrate WBO Day and FWBO Day, the founding of the movement. That was a very regular thing, sometimes very big celebrations in different centres. Bhante is very keen, I think, on, well, probably still is, on anniversaries and really marking significant times in the Buddhist calendar, not just the traditional Buddhist festival days, but also our own history. It sort of slightly got a bit lost, I think, which is a shame, because I think they were quite important events. When he was around, he'd often use them to really communicate his thoughts about the order and the spiritual path that we're on. So he on these days, he'd talk about, he gave that, he read that paper, The History of My Going for Refuge, which is now a book in itself, which is well worth reading, how he discovered the centrality of going for refuge for the Buddhist tradition. My Relation to the Order came out of this weekend, and various others. But on this occasion, the 16th anniversary of the founding of the order, he spoke about the 10 precepts that we take. And it was the first time that he'd given a connected account of all of the precepts. And he pointed out that 16 in the East is the time where you enter maturity. He invoked the image of the Bodhisattva, 16 being the time when you're anointed, you would be anointed as the crown prince, as the Yuvaraj who would take over the kingdom one day. And of course, this is the symbolism of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattvas are 16 because the Buddha is the king of the spiritual universe who anoints the Bodhisattvas to one day be the Buddha. There's a whole load of symbolism there. And there's always quite a lot of discussion about maturity in that, which is kind of interesting as we go on. I think that we were very, very immature when the order had been 16 years old, and still there's more and more growing up to do. Spiritual immaturity and spiritual maturity are actually very rare things, probably. And as the Buddha says in the section on the spiritually immature in the Dhammapada, that somebody who knows that they are immature, to that extent they are mature. Those who do not know that they are immature when they are immature indeed, etc., etc. And of course, Bhante's translation of the Balavaga and the Panditavaka, he's being rather kind, because Bala also means fool. That's the literal translation. The spiritually immature is the fool, and the spiritually mature is the wise man. He then, the first big section is the relationship between the refuges and the precepts. So he talks about going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. He starts there. Just one line that really struck me very early on in that passage. And Bhante is a very deceptive writer because he put things very plainly and very simply, and we can read it and not quite realise the full force of what he's saying. So he says very simply, in talking about going for refuge to the Buddha, it's to realise that to attain enlightenment is the most important thing in life. To attain enlightenment is the most important thing in life. Not just for one's own personal life, but in life. That's what it means to go for refuge to the Buddha. That's a very striking statement, which we could probably spend the rest of the retreat pondering. He talks about going for refuge being the highest common factor for all Buddhists. It's the central act of the Buddhist life. This is his great realization, that it's going for refuge that defines you as a Buddhist, not the particular set of precepts that you follow, the great many precepts of a bhikkhu or the much lesser precepts of the layperson. He thinks that sort of, you know, emphasizing the precepts you take, your ecclesiastical stasis, is divisive. And it's divided the Buddhist community. He says, no, it's going for refuge, and he's basing that on very good scriptural sources. It's going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha that unites you. This might all seem rather perhaps beside the point for many of us, but perhaps we don't fully realise how in traditional Buddhism this division between monk and lay, how strong it is. And you know, Bhante goes into it in various writings, that you have sort of first class and second class Buddhists to do with your particular status. Well, he wants to break through that and say, no, what defines you as a Buddhist is going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. That's the central act. He invokes the mandala principle, that this, you see your life as a mandala with the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha, not just at the centre, but in a mandala, the central figure of the mandala is elevated onto the top of a great mountain. It's an image of the universe. And everything is in relationship to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And of course there are some acts and behaviours, some things which are outside of the mandala. They have no place in the total transformation and reorganisation of one's life. He talks, therefore, in establishing going for refuge, in just a few lines, really. He then starts to talk about the relationship between going for refuge and the practice of the 10 precepts. He says it's not arbitrary. It's not that you go for refuge and then the precepts are a sort of add-on. They're continuous. They're like the relationship between the seed and the flower. The going for refuge is the seed, the flowering in life is the practice of the precepts, or the relationship between an artist and his oeuvre, his work. It's the expression of his being. He sees them as part of a single process of spiritual life and growth. I think this is important because, you know, sometimes you can get the situation where somebody's talking about their going for refuge in a rather vague way, meaning, oh, you know, a really vague way. They don't perhaps have in mind going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But their ethics are a bit dodgy. There are questions about them. And perhaps you might have maybe this is a hypothetical extreme case of somebody saying, yeah, but this is to do with my going for refuge. But the point is, your ethical life is intimately connected with going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You can't separate them out in the case of the 10 precepts. You cannot separate that shift in the direction of enlightenment and your behaviour in life generally. The really strong language that he uses is that if going for refuge is our life blood as a Buddhist, the practice of the precepts is the circulation of that blood. And of course, for blood to be blood, as he points out, it has to circulate. If it doesn't circulate, it, it, well, it congeals and the organism becomes dead. And our practice would just become rather mechanical. I find this very, very powerful, a very, very powerful metaphor. And it really does show the intimacy of the relationship between our going in the direction of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and our actual behaviour in all spheres of life, in body, speech and mind. It's the circulation of our lifeblood as a Buddhist. I remember a period in my own life where I was feeling really pretty dead spiritually, finding it was a particular solitary retreat. It was very, very dry. And then I realised that I'd been very unethical in certain areas of my life. And this came to mind, this particular thing. It's the reason why I felt dead, uninspired, not flowing, was to do with my ethics. It wasn't to do with tricks in meditation or, you know, reading a particular scripture or something like that. It was to do with particularly my lack of loving kindness, my compromises in that particular area. So if you're feeling a bit sort of dry and dead spiritually, don't forget ethics. What are you doing with the precepts? Not just the abstaining from unskillful things, but also the expression of the positive precepts. So that's a bit on the relationship between the refuges and the precepts. He then talks about the canonical sources. He says that some people have even wondered whether the 10 precepts that we take at our ordination are sort of properly Buddhist, because although they're mentioned a lot in the Pali Canon, they've never been regarded, for reasons that which are rather mysterious, as what they call a pratimoksha. Pratimoksha being the basic ethical code. The 5 precepts have been, and the different versions of monasticism have been regarded as a pratimoksha. But the 10 precepts, which are mentioned time and again, not just in the Pali Canon, but in the Mahayana, in Vajrayana, throughout the Buddhist world, for some weird reason, have never been sort of, as it were, as far as I know this to be the case, taken at the time of an ordination, taken and given a time of ordination. Very strange, sort of weird kind of lacuna in Buddhist history. And I remember when we were in India, our order members, before we became Dharmacharis and Dharmacharinis, we had to start styling ourselves Dasha Shila Upasakas, 10 precept Upasakas, because our order members were clearly doing more for the Dharma than a lot of bhikkhus, and certainly most upasakas generally in the Buddhist community. And we had to make it clear that we were following a different code. But the trouble is, the word dashashila can refer to a kind of shramanera type ordination. So, and we did get questions: are you properly Buddhist, following proper Buddhist ethics? Of course, people hadn't studied the suttas deeply enough. So Bhante wants to really cover that, and you know, he makes a number of quotations from the Pali sources which make it very clear how important these 10 precepts are. So he gives the full Buddhist tradition. There are probably more places actually where the 10 precepts are mentioned. They have different titles as well. They're not just the 10 precepts. They're known as Dasa, Kushala Karma Pata, the 10 ways of skillful action, the Kushala Dharmas, the 10 skillful or positive qualities, the negative side of the Akushala Dharmas, the 10 unskillful qualities, and so on and so forth, the 10 Shiksha Padas, and so on and so forth. So they are all there. And he mentions in the Mahayana that perfect observance of the 10 precepts, even in dreams, is a sign that you're an irreversible bodhisattva. This is in the one of the oldest Perfection of Wisdom sutras. So if you're wondering whether you're irreversible, whether you've entered the stream and you're not coming back to samsara, check out your precepts. Are you naturally following them even in your dreams? So and so on and so forth. There's also, It's practicing the 10 precepts and encouraging others to practice the 10 precepts that is part of the purification of the Buddha field, the building of the Buddha land, as we call it. So it has a transformation of world aspect to it. It's also one of the practices to give birth to the Tathagata Kaya, the body of the Tathagata, the body of the Buddha. This is mentioned in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. It's a wonderfully inspiring passage where Vimalakirti is sick and he's saying how you should really despair of this body which is so overwhelmingly impermanent and so on. And instead, all beings should develop their aspirations to give birth to the body of the Buddha. It's spiritual rebirth. And one of the main practices to bring about being reborn as the body of the Tathagata, the body of the Buddha, is the practice of the 10 precepts. I find that a particularly inspiring thought, that my vigorous practice of the 10 precepts, such as it is, or rather, let's put it another way, that if I was more vigorous in my practice of the 10 precepts, I would be creating a different body. A different body here, kaya, means something like personality. A different kind of being would be being created. So it's directly related to, not just gaining enlightenment, but becoming the living presence of enlightenment in the world. He then goes on to talk about total transformation. The 10 precepts and total transformation. One of the reasons why the 10 precepts are so important is that they are concerned with body, speech and mind. You've got 3 precepts to do with bodily action. You've got 4 precepts to do with vocal action. And you've got 3 precepts to do with mental action. So they cover a whole range of our personality, body, speech and mind. A lot of other precept sets are much more concerned with the minutiae of behaviour, particularly the bhikkhu precepts. They're much more concerned with very particular circumstances and situations, to do with your behaviour. It's not that they're not to do with being skillful, but they're very, very specific. Whereas the 10 precepts are concerned with working on body, speech and mind. So he goes into the different ways in that section of how Buddhist tradition and indeed other traditions analyse the human personality. It's a very interesting section, which again you could probably spend years exploring. The next section is called the 10 precepts as principles of ethics. And there's quite a lot of definition here. Bhante's very keen on dictionary definitions, defining terms. He's a great lover of Confucius's famous rejoinder when he was asked, what's the first thing you would do for the reformation of the state? And he said, the rectification of terms. So in other words, defining what you mean by the words you use, and making sure in the communication situation that we are both talking about the same thing. So being very, very clear about our language. A big feature of Bhante's teaching, which very easily gets lost and neglected. I know sometimes people could be a bit irritated when he gives dictionary definitions. And when we were having discussions in seminar with him, he'd insist on asking us what we meant when we used a certain word. He didn't assume that he knew what we meant. And that could be very, very challenging if you were asking a question. You hadn't thought deeply enough about the words that you were using. It's like I say, you could get a bit irritated. I remember Dharmarati one time on a seminar here, spending a whole day formulating a question so that Bhante wouldn't answer, well, what do you mean by that word? Didn't work, because the first thing he did was, well, what do you mean by? And Bhante wasn't being funny. It wasn't a game. It was looking back it was really sort of Socratic, I guess. It was Socratic dialogue. What do you mean by the words you're using? What do you mean by the thoughts that you have? What are your assumptions? So, yes, he's very concerned with definitions. So he gives the definitions of principles. He gives the definitions of ethics. You can look them up. But in terms of principles of ethics, I think I'm right in saying this is, as a sort of working translation of the terms for the precepts in terms of the Kushala Dharmas. The Kushala Dharmas. Kushala being the term for the ethical, and Dharma being a translation, could be translated as the term for principle here. Kushala Dharmas. You can look all this up. And what I think is particularly important here for us to dwell on is this definition of Kushala. Skillful. Very often when we're all very pleased when we hear about the definitions of Buddhist ethics, that it's an ethics of intention, that it's to do with the state of mind with which you perform it. And we say, well, Kushala means that you're behaving without greed, without hatred, without delusion, with contentment, loving kindness, and clear thinking. That's probably usually the way we explain Kushala. And it's all about your intention. Although, again, I think while we're on the matter of intention, we need to be very, very careful with that, because that doesn't mean you don't pay attention to the actual effects that you're having on people. Oh, but I was well-intentioned, when the other person's really upset by your rough speech or something like that, doesn't mean that. And there are also Buddhist traditions that talk very, very clearly, and this is brought out particularly in the Bodhisattva tradition, that you need to pay attention to the effect that you have on people. And if you're having a negative effect on people, you need to investigate that. Equally, if you're, you can't just say, well, I meant well. You need to go a bit deeper into it than that. That's perhaps an area for discussion. Somebody might be upset by our actions when we're actually behaving skillfully. So there's an interesting one to do with our relationships with other people. But the thing I particularly want to draw out is he gives, if you like, the ideal definition of Kushala, of skillful. And I want to read this because it really does require some pondering. So I'll just read this paragraph. Kushala is a very important term. In its broader significance, it means clever, skillful, or expert, in the sense of knowing how to act in a way that is beneficial rather than otherwise. Kushala karma, or skillful action, thus is action which is directed towards securing both for oneself and others the best possible results in terms of happiness, knowledge, and freedom. That is, it is action which is constantly mindful of the law of karma. It is action which is constantly mindful of the law of karma, as well as of the painful, impermanent, and insubstantial nature of conditioned existence, and of the blissful, permanent, and empty nature of the unconditioned. Kushala, thus, is an ethical term, since it is a term which is applied, in the words of our definition of ethics, to human behaviour, insofar as that behaviour is considered with regard to the notions of right and wrong. Nor is that all. The term Kushala is not applied to human behaviour considered with regard to notions of right or wrong in any merely abstract or comparative sense. It is applied to it as considered with regard to a very definite and specific notion which the term Kushala itself implies, and which it even embodies. That is, the notion that right is what conduces to the attainment of enlightenment, and wrong what does not. The meaning of ethics and the meaning of Kushala therefore coincide. Kushala is not simply an ethical term. Kushala is itself the ethical. That, I really think, requires considerable pondering. You know, that if we're going to practice Buddhist ethics. We've got to really be developing right view and even insight into the nature of life, as well as, of course, loving kindness and all the rest of it. But I think this business of constantly mindful of the law of karma, that probably is the first place to really reflect. How often are we mindful of the law of karma? Or is our notion of what's right and what's good is kind of what we can get away with, or what pleases people, or something like that? But constantly mindful of the law of karma. I think this is really the fundamental Buddhist insight, most important Buddhist insight, that there is an ethical ordering to the universe, that skillful actions lead to happiness and freedom for self and others, unskillful actions lead to the opposite. It's the theme, of course, of the first two verses of the Dhammapada, just to read them to you, just to remind you of them. The pairs, the Yamakavaga, experiences, that's Dharma's, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So we really need to get to grips with this business of the law of karma, and perhaps even do a little bit of asking of ourselves: Do I really believe that karma is the fundamental Buddhist insight? Am I living in accordance with that idea that there is an ethical ordering to things, or do I have more of a sense of it's just chance or materiality or psychology or politics that is the major kind of driving force? We really need to get to grips with this. It's one of the fundamental aspects of Shraddha, trusting Shraddha, trusting faith, as it's called. This deep trust in the Dharma is founded on karma, insight into karma, or at least conviction into the karmic ordering of things. And we can also do a little test on ourselves that really notice our actions. When we behave skillfully, what is the effect? Might not be immediate, but what is the reverberation when we behave skillfully? When we're behaving unskillfully, what are the reverberations on ourselves and others of that? So really some pondering to do there on Kushala, and particularly its relationship, obviously, to wisdom and insight into the nature of things, into real Dharma understanding. He also talks about these 10 precepts as principles. This is important because he, as you'll see, he does this brilliantly in his exposition of the 10 precepts. He's very concerned to establish the ethical principle first of all. He doesn't get into hypothetical discussions of, have I broken the precept if I do this? Have I kept the precept if I do this? You'll find this in the study group, probably, that people will bring up perhaps hypothetical situations of what's in and out of the precept. Perhaps be a bit more than that. They might even bring up real dilemmas. Is it following the precept if I do this? Is it breaking it if I do this? Dilemmas are good. Hypothetical situations are a bit of a waste of time. Sometimes I think when we bring those up, it's to avoid engaging with really understanding the principle, because that's what we need to do. If we're going to live these precepts, we have to go deeply into the principle. By principle, it doesn't mean an abstract idea. It means a sort of living spiritual principle, Dharma principle by which we live. And, he says that, again, one of the problems with lists of Buddhist ethics sometimes, it's to do with the minutiae of behaviour, which really don't have a lot to do with sort of deeper spiritual principles. He then goes on to, if you like, the application of these principles to a training. He talks about the 10 precepts as rules of training. This is rules of training being a translation here of sikkhapada, shikshapada in Sanskrit. So when we take the 10 precepts, when we chant them in the puja, we're chanting the 5 precepts, we're chanting the sikkhapadas. So rules of training or items of training, bases of training, that's what we're talking about here. He goes into etymology and definition, talks about the meaning of shiksha, noting that it's the training and learning, which you can translate shiksha into, comes from a root meaning able and capable. And he draws out the significance of that, that when we take the precepts, it means that we're able and willing and capable of taking those precepts and of learning those precepts and training in those precepts. So there's a question. How fit are we to take the precepts, to learn the precepts? How capable are we of doing that? Is there some work to do before we can actually really be capable of learning them and able and willing to learn them and practicing them? He also brings out the fact that you take them, you learn them from a preceptor, from a teacher, because at the time of your ordination, yes, it is a witnessing of going for refuge, and in a sense a witnessing of the fact that you're already practicing the precepts to some extent, but you're also entering into a training. I think this is very important. We don't often talk in this way for various reasons, but in entering in the order, you're definitely entering into a specific training which has its origins in Sangharakshita's translation of the Dharma. A quite specific training in ethics, meditation and wisdom and a whole sort of Dharmic culture. And of course, you'll have your own preceptor who will give you the precepts at the time of ordination, a private and public preceptor, and speaking as a private and public preceptor, just to get it straight, this is extremely challenging. This is extremely challenging when Bhante talks about you are taking them or learning them from a preceptor. Well, that begs questions of a preceptor as well, and the quality of one's own practice as a preceptor. It's famous phrase of Subhuti that Bhante is very fond of quoting, that in witnessing another's going for refuge, my own is called into question. I need to test whether I'm really living the life as well. So it's preceptors are challenged as well. We order members are challenged as well in transmitting these precepts to you, as well as you feeling challenged by them. So it's a completely equal situation in that way. So don't worry about that if you were. But we're able and capable and willing to learn these precepts and train in them. So if you have any doubts about the sorts of doubts one could have, whether this training is worthwhile, investigate those doubts, or if one has any doubts in one's capacity, well, bring them out, talk about them. Is that just a bit of a lack of confidence, or actually is it you're just becoming very seriously aware of the challenge of observing these precepts in their thoroughness? It's okay to feel a bit slightly daunted by that. They're very high ideals that we're following. Maybe you even have doubts about the practice that you've seen of the precepts by the order members that you're in touch with, and you might have questions about that. What I'm trying to get at here is don't suppress your doubts about any aspect of the training and the quality of the people training, and hope that, oh, well, they'll get sorted out after I'm ordained. Very bad idea. Very bad idea. Ordination is a very powerful initiation. We don't often talk like that, but it is. And it becomes harder, I think, to sort things out after ordination than before. So bring out any personal doubts that you might have about the training and your capacity for it, the quality of it. Bring that out in your groups. Bhante also points out that this whole language of training is very, very strong in Buddhist tradition. Again, in our super soft focused modern world, we don't often talk like this. You know, the language tends to be we're all right already, and we just need a bit of massaging to make things a bit better. It's not the way the Buddha talks. He is the charioteer of men to be trained, the Purisa Dhamma Sarati. He is the charioteer of men to be tamed, the charioteer, as though we're horses in a chariot being tamed. And you get this a lot in Buddhist tradition, that the person who is training for enlightenment is like a young horse, a mettlesome horse, as Bhante puts it, that needs quite a bit of breaking in. Of course, we're doing that. We have to do that for ourselves. He also invokes the wonderful ox herding pictures from the Zen tradition. Wonderful set of pictures, that the path is described as finding a young bull, a young ox. It's a bull, actually. And it's a whole, that spiritual life is about taming the bull. Well, it's wonderful. It's powerful. Image, isn't it, that we're like young bulls, and we're going to be trained. I remember an old Indian order member named Sangasen. Vivekaratna will remember this. Sangasen came to the Dharma late. His background was in trades unionism in Vidarbha region in India. He was an organizer for the Bidi Workers Union before he came to the Dharma. He's quite a powerful man in his way. Bidis are the country cigarettes. He's a tremendous character, and he came to the Dharma late and immediately got deeply involved, gave up his drinking, his alcoholism, gave up his tobacco chewing, gave up all those things, plunged into the Dharma very fully, was ordained by Bhante. Sangasen means the army of the Sangha, and he spent the rest of his life just communicating the Dharma. His family were all married off. His wife was okay in the big extended family, so he was free just to walk from village to village. And he liked to come on retreats with us when we were doing ordination retreats, actually, ordination training, going for refuge retreats. And he came into an order meeting one night. We were talking about one particular young man, and Sangasen, very direct speaker, he said, I asked him, do you want to be a bull or do you want to be a goat? And he didn't know what I meant, so I had to explain. Well, a goat stays at home around the house. The bull is in the field. And he said, no, I'm a bull. I want to be a bull. And so then I asked him, do you want to be a young bull or do you want to be a seasoned bull? And he said, well, what do you mean, a young bull or a seasoned bull? The young bull chases the cows. The seasoned bull works for the Dharma. No, I'm a seasoned bull. Anyway, so that tradition was certainly alive in India when I lived there, and I've never forgotten that. Do we want to be a seasoned bull? Very masculine imagery, isn't it? I hope that doesn't offend anybody. But anyway. So capable of training, capable of being learning from someone. And then he talks about what training in the 10 precepts mean. And I gave a whole talk, which I think is one of the recommended booklets on this. I was so taken with this. It's when I first came here and was studying the 10 precepts. And the great thing about leading study regularly on this material, you notice things that you just passed over. And there's a great list of training of the 10 precepts involves imbibing the spirit of the precept rather than just going by the letter, learning how to apply the precept to the affairs of daily life, learning how to confess breaches of the precepts, learning how to make good the breaches, making and keeping vows. Wonderful set of teachings there, which Yes, I gave that talk a long time ago. I'm sure it could be improved. And again, a really good list. And you could, again, you probably have the whole path in that list. The next section is called the Ten Precepts as Mula Pratimoksha, as the fundamental ethical code. This might be a slightly arcane section to have, but for Bhante it's extremely important. Bhante, of course, being a real traditionalist who's really lived in the suttas and the Buddhist tradition and Buddhist history, he comes out of that. And this word, and of course he was ordained as a bhikkhu, as a bhikshu, although, you know, over the years he's come to see that a much bigger and deeper picture. So for him, the word pratimoksha, or patimokkha in Pali, has a lot of resonance. I mean, patimokkha is traditionally associated with the very long list of rules that a bhikkhu takes at ordination, but it's actually traditionally a much richer term than that. There are a number of sets of pratimokshas which go with the particular ordination you take, and there's even, I think, a lay pratimoksha. But the origins of the term, as Bhante says, is quite mysterious. You know, and he goes into the etymology of it and so on. I think he references the Tibetan interpretation, which means something like the basis for liberation. And I think that's probably the best way of looking at the pratimoksha. It's the basic code and training for the liberation of the individual. But what I like about this particular term is, if you think back, some scholars believe that the earliest pratimoksha of all is some verses in the Dhammapada which begin, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the heart. This is the teaching of the sasana of all the Buddhas. And there's a few other verses after this. This is, I think it's in the Buddhavagga, the section on the enlightened one, although it's passed off as the pratimoksha of an extremely ancient Buddha. Some people believe that's because the earliest pratimoksha was the recitation of your basic doctrine, of your basic teaching, and later on came to be associated with all the rules. But the thing is that the sort of, if you like, almost mythic, traditional resonance here is that every full moon, I think every new moon, there'd be an order meeting of the bhikkhus, and there probably were equivalents for other Buddhist socio-religious groups. But the monks would come together. We know this from the suttas. They'd gather together originally around the Buddha. There'd be silence and space for confession, and there'd be recitation of the pratimoksha. Probably originally it was just recitation of the fundamental doctrine. Maybe even the pratimoksha was shared. This was the way the different Shramana groups, the different wandering groups following different spiritual traditions practice. You can imagine it. You'd want to come together, and what would you do? You'd sit in meditation, in silence, and then you'd rehearse, you'd recite your basic doctrine and teaching. We do this in our own chapter, and I'm sure other chapters do it every and we're going to do it tonight. We come together, and the first thing we do is recite our refuges and precepts, then sit in silence, and then confess our faults, and then move into the chapter business. And I sort of feel that we're following an old, ancient tradition that even goes back to the Buddha. But what Bhante is saying, he feels that, or sees, or believes that the Ten Precepts have claim to be the Mula Pratimoksha. It's not a traditional term. It's a term that he's coined, though he doesn't think it's untraditional. Mula meaning here something like root, basic, fundamental. The fundamental, basic ethical code for all Buddhists. regardless of whether they're householders, I didn't use the word layperson, Banti says no order member should describe themselves as a layperson. They might be householders with families and those responsibilities, but they're not lay in the sense, lay has the idea of part-time, perhaps even second class. No, none of that. So regardless of whether you're a householder or somebody like myself living in a community, living full-time for the Dharma, some people are even like monks, they are anagarikas, they're brahmacharis. Our fundamental ethical code within our order, within our movement, is the 10 precepts. That transcends all other distinctions. This is a very, very powerful point. He believes that the going for refuge and the 10 precepts are the great unifiers within Buddhist tradition. That should unify all Buddhists. Whereas other ethical codes and the emphasis on whether you're monk or lay divides. He actually goes even further than that. He quotes, and he says, he goes into the reasons why it's the Mulam Pratimoksha, because it covers the whole of the path. It covers ethics, meditation and wisdom. It covers body, speech and mind. It covers the totality of our behaviour. It's concerned with principles, and we have to work out the application of those principles, whereas some of the other ethical lists are concerned with a very particular application, even of a particular application of a precept to a particular time, like in India, at a particular period. He goes even further than that. He quotes from a sutta where it's this very important sutta that the Buddha gives to Sariputta, the Sevitabha Asevitabha Sutta, that which should be followed and that which should be not, where there's a real exposition of the 10 precepts. This sutta concludes with the Buddha talking. And Sariputta, if all nobles, all Brahmins, all merchants, all workers could thus understand the meaning in full of this that was spoken by me in brief on the 10 precepts, for a long time it would be for their welfare and happiness. And Sariputta, if the world with its gods, with the Maras and Brahmas, and if the generations of recluses and Brahmins, Devas and men, could thus understand the meaning in full of this that was spoken by me in brief, for a long time it would be for their welfare and happiness. And Bhante's comment, this would suggest that the 10 precepts represent the norm of ethical behaviour, not only for all Buddhists, but for all human beings, indeed for all forms of self-conscious, sentient existence. That's a very, very powerful statement of the Buddha, that this is the ethical norm for all self-conscious, sentient life, going right up into the heavenly realms. Very, very powerful that in observing these precepts, we're connecting more and more deeply with the whole of life all around us. He then goes on to the 10 precepts and other ethical formulae. He's here concerned just to link up the 10 precepts with the threefold path of ethics, meditation and wisdom, and the Noble Eightfold Path, and says it would be helpful if a chart was drawn up of this. He doesn't give the chart, but basically he's saying in observing the 10 precepts fully, you are following the whole of the path. And finally, he comes to the question of the 10 precepts and lifestyle. And he does a bit of work on this famous phrase, commitment is primary and lifestyle is secondary. Wondering who was responsible for this particular phrase and wondering if it was him. I think it probably was. But doing a bit of clarification about what it meant. He really goes into the whole business of lifestyle not being neutral. That's not what he meant by it. It's more that really he says it should be threefold. Commitment, going for refuge, is primary. The 10 precepts is secondary, only insofar as it's the expression of the precepts, and lifestyle is tertiary. But the main point he was really concerned with when he was talking about lifestyle, it's not anything to do with, it's not that you can't question the way someone lives. It's not saying that we can't, that your behaviour cannot be looked at and scrutinised. It's much more to do with the fact that, look, what's really important is we are going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and practicing the precepts first. Whether we live a monastic type life or whether we live a householder type life is secondary. That shouldn't be in any way creating a division between us within the spiritual community. As he says, I think earlier on in the text, that if we really believe this, that going for refuge is primary, lifestyle is secondary, there's an elevation into a Mahasangha, a great Buddhist spiritual community, rather than having any divisions between us. But it doesn't close us off to the teaching. I think that there's a lot of power in this phrase, actually. Commitment is primary, lifestyle secondary, if you understand it properly. What it means, one of the things it means is there is no Dharma teaching which is sort of off limits to you. You can't say, oh, I live at home with my family and I have this job, so I can't look at this particular ethical teaching, which is, you know, might be very sort of challenging and demanding. For example, let's take the subject of renunciation or going forth. Now, obviously, if you have a family and dependents, you can't go forth as the Buddha went forth. That would be irresponsible to do that. You have responsibilities which, you know, where the Buddhist ethical thing to do is to follow that through. Nonetheless, the founder of our tradition went forth. He taught renunciation for everybody. So what does that particular teaching mean when we have all those other responsibilities? You can't just say, that's off limits. That way of looking at things is off limits. You have to open up to it and see what it might mean for you, because the simple life is absolutely indispensable to living a Dharma life. And yet, people live in quite complex situations. So how do we practice there? Similarly, it's very important if you have the privilege, if you like, of not having lots and lots of family responsibilities. You are, say, a free individual man, maybe even quite a young man. You don't have any special status because of that. I don't have any special status because I live in a great place like Padmaloka and I've got all the opportunities for practice. I don't have any special status, for example, in a chapter meeting where people live in different ways. What defines us is the going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and the practice of the 10 precepts. That's what's really important, and that's what he's really getting at with commitment is primary, lifestyle is secondary. Not trying to avoid engagement with the way that we actually live our lives. So that's the things that have sort of struck me about the first section of the 10 Pillars of Buddhism. I hope you found that helpful. I hope it will stimulate some discussion tomorrow. And I hope, maybe some of you will even follow it up, because there's so many things to pull out from that. Just to remind you that this evening it's meditation and puja with Paramabandhu leading, beginning outside, walking and chanting around the stupa courtyard, around Dada Rinpoche's relics. And just to remind you as well of the going for refuge and prostration practice at 4:30 this afternoon. Padmasagara will be doing his introduction to that, and you'll be doing a bit of it, so do come to that. Okay, we'll finish there. Thank you. Yeah.